Black Notice by Patricia Cornwell. This book consists of 41 chapters and is 412 pages long. Dedication to Nina Salter, Water and Words. And the third angel poured out his vial upon the rivers and fountains of waters, and they became blood. Revelation 16:4. Black Notice. B.W., December 6, 1996, Epworth Heights, Ludington, Michigan. My dearest Kay, I'm sitting on the porch, staring out at Lake Michigan as a sharp wind reminds me I need to cut my hair. I am remembering when we were here last, both of us abandoning who and what we are for one precious moment in the history of our time. Kay, I need you to listen to me. You are reading this because I am dead. When I decided to write it, I asked Senator Lord to deliver it to you in person in the early part of December, a year after my death. I know how hard Christmas has always been for you, and now it must be unbearable. Loving you was when my life began. Now that it has ended, your gift to me is to go on. Of course, you haven't dealt with a damn thing, Kay. You have sped like hell to crime scenes and done more autopsies than ever. You have been consumed by court and running the Institute, with lecturing, worrying about Lucy, getting irritated with Marino, eluding your neighbors and fearing the night. You haven't taken a vacation or a sick day, no matter how much you've needed it. It's time to stop dodging your pain and let me comfort you. Hold my hand in your mind, and remember the many times we talked about death, never accepting that any disease or accident or act of violence has the power of absolute annihilation, because our bodies are just the suits we wear, and we are so much more than that. Kay, I want you to believe I am somehow aware of you as you read this, somehow looking after you, and that everything's going to be all right. I ask you to do one thing for me to celebrate a life we've had that I know will never end. Call Marino and Lucy. Invite them over for dinner tonight. Cook one of your famous meals for them, and save a place for me. I love you forever, Kay. Benton. 1. The late morning blazed with blue skies and the colors of fall, but none of it was for me. Sunlight and beauty were for other people now, my life stark and without song. I stared out the window at a neighbor raking leaves and felt helpless, broken, and gone. Benton's words resurrected every awful image I had repressed. I saw beams of light picking out heat-shattered bones in soggy trash and water. Shock rocked me again when confusing shapes turned into a scorched head with no features and clumps of sooty silver hair. I was sitting at my kitchen table sipping hot tea that Senator Frank Lord had brewed for me. I was exhausted and light-headed from storms of nausea that had sent me fleeing to the bathroom twice. I was humiliated because beyond all things I feared losing control, and I just had. "I need to rake the leaves again," I inanely said to my old friend. "December 6th, and it's like October. Look out there, Frank. The acorns are big. Have you noticed? Supposedly that means a hard winter, but it doesn't even look like we're going to have winter. I can't remember if you have acorns in Washington."
"We do," he said. "If you can find a tree or two."
"Are they big? The acorns, I mean."
"I'll be sure to look, Kay."
I covered my face with my hands and sobbed. He got up from the table and came around to my chair. Senator Lord and I had grown up in Miami and had gone to school in the same archdiocese, although I attended St. Brendan's High School only 1 year and long after he was there. Yet that somewhat removed crossing of paths was a sign of what would come. When he was the district attorney, I was working for the Dade County Medical Examiner's Office and often testified in his cases. When he was elected a United States Senator and then appointed the chairman of the Judiciary Committee, I was the chief medical examiner of Virginia, and he began calling on me to lend my voice in his fight against crime. I was stunned when he called me yesterday to say he was coming to see me and had something important to deliver. I barely slept all night.
I was devastated when he walked into my kitchen and slipped the simple white envelope out of a pocket of his suit. As I sat with him now, it made perfect sense that Benton would have trusted him this much. He knew Senator Lord cared deeply for me and would never let me down. How typical of Benton to have a plan that would be executed perfectly, even though he wasn't around to see it through. How typical of him to predict my behavior after his death, and for every word of it to be true. "Kay," Senator Lord said, standing over me as I wept in my chair, "I know how hard this must be, and I wish I could make it all go away. I think one of the hardest things I've ever done was promise Benton I would do this. I never wanted to believe this day would come, but it has, and I'm here for you." He fell silent, then added, "No one's ever asked me to do anything like this before, and I've been asked a lot of things." "He wasn't like other people," I quietly replied, as I willed myself to calm down. "You know that, Frank. Thank God you do." Senator Lord was a striking man who bore himself with the dignity of his office. He had thick gray hair and intense blue eyes, was tall and lean, and dressed, as was typical, in a conservative dark suit, accented by a bold, bright tie, cufflinks, pocket watch, and stickpin. I got up from my chair and took a deep, shaky breath. I snatched several tissues from a box and wiped my face and nose. "You were very kind to come here," I said to him. "What else can I do for you?" he replied with a sad smile. "You've done it all by being here. I can't imagine the trouble you've gone to, your schedule and all."
"I must admit I flew in from Florida. And by the way, I checked on Lucy, and she's doing great things down there," he said.
Lucy, my niece, was an agent for the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, or ATF. Recently, she had been reassigned to the Miami field office, and I hadn't seen her for months.
"Does she know about the letter?" I asked Senator Lord.
"No," he answered, looking out the window at a perfect day.
"I think that's your call to make.
And she's feeling rather neglected by you, I might add." "By me?" I said, surprised. "She's the one who can't be reached. At least I'm not undercover chasing gun traffickers and other persons of such fine character. She can't even talk to me unless she's at headquarters or on a payphone."
"You're not easy to find, either. You've been elsewhere in your spirit since Benton died. Missing in action, and I don't even think you realize it," he said. "I know. I've tried to reach out to you, too, haven't I?"
Tears flooded my eyes again.
"And if I get hold of you, what do you tell me? Everything's fine, just busy. Not to mention you haven't come to see me once. Now and then in the old days you even brought me some of your special soups. You haven't been taking care of those who love you. You haven't been taking care of yourself."
He had covertly glanced up at the clock several times now. I got up from my chair.
"Are you heading back to Florida?"
I asked, in an unsteady voice.
"Afraid not. Washington," he said. "I'm on Face the Nation again. More of the same. I'm so disgusted by it all, Kay."
"I wish I could do something to help you," I said to him.
"It's dirty out there, Kay. If certain people knew I was here alone in your house with you, they'd start some vicious rumor about me. I'm sure of it."
"I wish you hadn't come here, then."
"Nothing would have stopped me. And I shouldn't be railing on about Washington. You have enough to deal with."
"I'll vouch for your sterling character any time," I said.
"It wouldn't do any good if it came to that."
I walked him through the impeccable house I had designed, past fine furniture and art and the antique medical instruments I collected, and over bright rugs and hardwood floors. Everything was precisely to my taste, but not at all the same as it had been when Benton was here. I paid no more attention to my home than I did to myself these days. I had become a heartless custodian of my life, and it was evident everywhere I looked. Senator Lord noticed my briefcase open on the great room couch, and case files, mail, and memos spilled over the glass coffee table and legal pads on the floor. Cushions were askew, an ashtray dirty because I'd started smoking again. He didn't lecture me.
"Kay, do you understand I've got to have limited contact with you after this?" Senator Lord said.
because of what I just alluded to. God, look at this place, I blurted out in disgust. I just can't seem to keep up anymore.
There've been rumors, he cautiously went on. I won't go into them. There have been veiled threats.
Anger heated his voice. Just because we're friends. I used to be so neat. I gave a heartbroken laugh. Fenton and I were always squabbling about my house, my shit, my perfectly appointed, perfectly arranged shit.
My voice rose as grief and fury flared up higher than before.
If he rearranged or put something in the wrong drawer... That's what happens when you hit middle age and have lived alone and had everything your own goddamn way.
Kay, are you listening to me? I don't want you to feel I don't care if I don't call you very much, if I don't invite you up for lunch or to get your advice about some bill I'm trying to pass.
Right now I can't even remember when Tony and I got divorced, I bitterly said.
What? 1983?
He left. So what? I didn't need him or anyone else who followed. I could make my world the way I wanted it, and I did. My career, my possessions, my investments. And look!
I stood still in the foyer and swept my hand over my beautiful stone house and all that was in it.
So what? So fucking what?
I looked Senator Lord in the eye.
Benton could dump garbage in the middle of this fucking house. He could tear the goddamn place down. I just wish none of it had ever mattered, Frank.
I wiped away furious tears.
I wish I could do it over and never criticize him once about anything. I just want him here. Oh, God, I want him here. Every morning I wake up not remembering and then it hits again, and I can barely get out of bed.
Tears ran down my face. It seemed every nerve in my body had gone haywire.
You made Benton very happy. Senator Lord said gently and with feeling.
You meant everything to him. He told me how good you were to him, how much you understood the hardships of his life, the awful things he had to see when he was working those atrocious cases for the FBI. Deep down, I know you know that.
I took a deep breath and leaned against the door.
And I know he would want you to be happy now, to have a better life. If you don't, then the end result of loving Benton Wesley will prove damaging and wrong, something that ruined your life. Ultimately a mistake. Does that make sense?
Yes, I said. Of course. I know exactly what he would want right now. I know what I want. I don't want it like this. This is almost more than I can bear. At times I've thought I would snap, just fall apart and end up on a ward somewhere. Or maybe in my own damn morgue.
Well, you won't. He took my hand in both of his. If there's anything I know about you, it's that you will prevail against all odds. You always have, and this stretch of your journey happens to be the hardest, but there's a better road ahead, I promise, Kay.
I hugged him hard. Thank you, I whispered. Thank you for doing this, for not leaving it in some file somewhere, not remembering, not bothering.
Now you'll call me if you need me, he pretty much ordered as I opened the front door. But you'll keep in mind what I said and promise you won't feel ignored.
I understand.
I'm always there if you need me. Don't forget that. My office always knows where I am.
I watched the black Lincoln drive off, then went into my great room and built a fire, although it wasn't cold enough to need one. I was desperate for something warm and alive to fill the emptiness left by Senator Lord's leaving. I read Benton's letter again and again, and heard his voice in my mind. I envisioned him with sleeves rolled up, veins prominent in strong forearms, his firm, elegant hands holding the silver Mont Blanc fountain pen I had given him, for no special reason, other than it was precise and pure like him. Tears would not stop. And I held up the page with his engraved initials, so his writing would not smear. His penmanship and the way he expressed himself had always been deliberate and spare, and I found his words a comfort and a torment as I obsessively studied them, dissecting, excavating for one more hint of meaning or tone. At intervals I almost believed he was cryptically telling me his death wasn't real, was part of an intrigue, a plan, something orchestrated by the FBI, the CIA, God only knew. Then the truth returned, bringing its hollow chill to my heart. Benton had been tortured and murdered. DNA, dental charts, personal effects had verified that the unrecognizable remains were his. I tried to imagine how I would honor his request tonight and didn't see how I could. It was ludicrous to think of Lucy's flying to Richmond, Virginia for dinner. I picked up the phone and tried to reach her anyway, because that was what Benton had asked me to do. She called me back on her portable phone about 15 minutes later. "The office said you're looking for me. What's going on?" she said cheerfully. "It's hard to explain," I began. "I wish I didn't always have to go through your field office to get to you." "Me too. And I know I can't say much." I started to get upset again. "What's wrong?" she cut in. "Benton wrote a letter. We'll talk another time." She interrupted again, and I understood, or at least I assumed I did. Cell phones were not secure. "Turn in right there," Lucy said to someone. "I'm sorry," she got back to me. "We're making a pit stop at Los Bobos to get a shot of colada." "A what?" "High-test caffeine and sugar in a shot glass." "Well, it's something he wanted me to read now, on this day. He wanted you..." "Never mind. It all seems so silly." I fought to sound as if I were held together just fine. "Gotta go," Lucy said to me. "Maybe you can call later." "Will do," she said in her same irritating tone. "Who are you with?" I prolonged the conversation, because I needed her voice, and I didn't want to hang up with the echo of her sudden coolness in my ear. "My psycho partner," she said. "Tell her hi." "She says hi," Lucy said to her partner Joe, who was Drug Enforcement Agency, or DEA. They worked together on a high-intensity drug trafficking area, or HIDTA, squad that had been relentlessly working a series of very vicious home invasions. Joe and Lucy's relationship was a partnership in another way, too, but they were very discreet. I wasn't sure ATF or DEA even knew. "Later," Lucy said to me, and the line went dead. 2. Richmond Police Captain Pete Marino and I had known each other for so long it sometimes seemed we were inside each other's heads. So it really came as no great surprise when he called me before I had a chance to track him down. "You sound really stopped up," he said to me. "You got a cold?"
"No," I said. "I'm glad you called because I was getting ready to call you."
"Oh, yeah?" I could tell he was smoking in either his truck or police car. Both had two-way radios and scanners that this moment were making a lot of noise.
"Where are you?"
I asked him. "Cruising around, listening to the scanner," he said, as if he had the top down and was having a wonderful day. "Counting the hours till retirement. Ain't life grand? Nothing missing but the bluebird of happiness." His sarcasm could have shred paper.
"What in the world's wrong with you?" I said.
"I'm assuming you know about the ripe one they just found at the port of Richmond," he replied. "People puking all over the place is what I hear. Just glad it ain't my fucking problem." My mind wouldn't work. I didn't know what he was talking about. Call waiting was clicking. I switched the cordless phone to the other ear as I walked into my study and pulled out a chair at the desk.
"What ripe one?" I asked him.
"Marino, hold on," I said as call waiting tried again.
"Let me see who this is. Don't go away."
I tapped the hang-up button.
"Scarpetta," I said.
"It's Jack," my deputy chief, Jack Fielding, said. "They found a body inside a cargo container at the port of Richmond, badly decomposed."
"That's what Marino was just telling me," I said.
"You sound like you've got the flu. I think I'm getting it, too. And Chuck's coming in late because he's not feeling so great, or so he says."
"Did this container just come off a ship?" I interrupted him.
"The Sirius, as in the Star. Definitely a weird situation. How do you want me to handle it?" I began scribbling notes on a call sheet, my handwriting more illegible than usual, my central nervous system as crashed as a bad hard drive. "I'll go," I said without pause, even as Benton's words pulsed in my mind. I was off and running again, maybe even faster this time. "You don't need to do that, Dr. Scarpetta," Fielding said, as if he were suddenly in charge. "I'll go down there. You're supposed to be taking the day off."
Who do I contact when I get there? I asked. I didn't want him to start in again.
Fielding had been begging me for months to take a break, to go somewhere for a week or two, or even consider a sabbatical. I was tired of people watching me with worried eyes. I was angered by the intimation that Benton's death was affecting my performance at work, that I'd begun isolating myself from my staff and others, and looked exhausted and distracted.
Detective Anderson notified us. She's at the scene, Fielding was saying.
Who?
Must be new.
Really, Dr. Scarpetta, I'll handle it.
Why don't you take a break? Stay home.
I realized I still had Marino on hold. I switched back to tell him I'd call as soon as I got off the line with my office. He'd already hung up.
Tell me how to get there, I said to my deputy chief.
I guess you're not going to accept my pro bono advice.
If I'm coming from my house, downtown expressway, and then what? I said.
He gave me directions. I got off the phone and hurried to my bedroom, Benton's letter in hand. I couldn't think of a place to keep it. I couldn't just leave it in a drawer or file cabinet. God forbid I should lose it or the housekeeper should discover it, and I didn't want it in a place where I might run across it unawares and be undone again. Thoughts spun wildly, my heart racing, adrenaline screaming through my blood as I stared at the stiff, creamy envelope, at K written in Benton's modest, careful hand. I finally focused on the small, fireproof safe bolted to the floor in my closet. I frantically tried to remember where I had written down the combination.
"I'm losing my goddamn mind!" I exclaimed out loud.
The combination was where I always kept it, between pages 670 and 671 of the 7th edition of Hunter's Tropical Medicine. I locked the letter in the safe and walked into the bathroom, and repeatedly splashed cold water on my face. I called Rose, my secretary, and instructed her to arrange for a removal service to meet me at the Port of Richmond in about an hour and a half.
"Let them know the body's in very sorry shape," I emphasized.
"How are you going to get there?" Rose asked.
"I'd tell you to stop here first and get the Suburban, but Chuck's taken it in for an oil change.
I thought he was sick.
He showed up 15 minutes ago and left with the Suburban."
"Okay, I'll have to use my own car.
Rose, I'm going to need the Luma light and 100-foot extension cord. Have someone meet me in the parking lot with them. I'll call when I'm close."
"You need to know that Jean's in a bit of an uproar."
"What's the problem?" I asked, surprised.
Jean Adams was the office administrator, and she rarely showed emotion, much less got upset.
"Apparently all the coffee money disappeared. You know this isn't the first time."
"Damn," I said.
"Where was it kept?"
"Locked up in Jean's desk drawer, like always.
Doesn't look like the lock was pried open or anything, but she went into the drawer this morning. No money. $111.35.
"This has got to stop," I said.
"I don't know if you're aware of the latest," Rose went on. "Lunches have started disappearing from the break room. Last week, Cleta accidentally left her portable phone on her desk overnight, and the next morning it was gone. Same thing happened to Dr. Riley. He left a nice pen in the pocket of his lab coat. Next morning, no pen."
"The crew that cleans up after hours?"
"Maybe," Rose said. "But I will tell you, Dr. Scarpetta, and I'm not trying to accuse anyone, I'm afraid it might be an inside job."
"You're right. We shouldn't accuse anyone. Is there any good news today?"
"Not so far," Rose matter-of-factly replied.
Rose had worked for me since I had been appointed chief medical examiner, which meant she had been running my life for most of my career. She had the remarkable ability to know virtually everything going on around her without getting caught up in it herself. My secretary remained untainted, and although the staff was somewhat afraid of her, she was the first one they ran to when there was a problem.
"Now you take care of yourself, Dr. Scarpetta," she went on. "You sound awful. Why don't you let Jack go to the scene and you stay in for once?"
"I'll just take my car," I said, as a wave of grief rolled over me and sounded in my voice.
Rose caught it and wrote it out in silence. I could hear her shuffling through papers on her desk. I knew she wanted to somehow comfort me, but I had never allowed that.
"Well, make sure you change before you get back in it," she finally said.
"Change what?"
your clothes. Before you get back into your car, she said, as if I'd never dealt with a decomposed body before.
Thank you, Rose, I said.
3. I set the burglar alarm and locked the house, turning on the light in the garage, where I opened a spacious locker built of cedar, with vents along the top and bottom. Inside were hiking boots, waders, heavy leather gloves, and a barber coat, with its special waterproofing that reminded me of wax. Out here I kept socks, long underwear, jumpsuits, and other gear that would never see the inside of my house. Their end of tour landed them in the industrial-sized stainless steel sink and washer and dryer not meant for my normal clothes. I tossed a jumpsuit, a pair of black leather Reeboks, and an Office of Chief Medical Examiner, or OCME, baseball cap inside the trunk. I checked my large Halliburton aluminum scene case to make sure I had plenty of latex gloves, heavy-duty trash bags, disposable sheets, camera, and film. I set out with a heavy heart as Benton's words drifted through my mind again. I tried to block out his voice, his eyes and smile, and the feel of his skin. I wanted to forget him, and more than anything, I didn't. I turned on the radio as I followed the downtown expressway to I-95, the Richmond skyline sparkling in the sun. I was slowing at the Lombardy Toll Plaza when my car phone rang. It was Marino.
"Thought I'd let you know I'm going to drop by," he said.
A horn blared when I changed lanes and almost clipped a silver Toyota in my blind spot. The driver swooped around me, yelling obscenities I couldn't hear.
"Go to hell,"
I angrily said in his wake.
"What?"
Marino said loudly in my ear. "Some goddamn idiot driver."
"Oh, good. You ever heard of road rage, Doc?"
"Yes, and I've come down with it." I took the 9th Street exit, heading to my office, and let Rose know I was 2 minutes away. When I pulled into the parking lot, Fielding was waiting with the hard case and extension cord.
"I don't guess the Suburban's back yet," I said.
"Nope," he replied, loading the equipment in my trunk.
"Gonna be something when you show up in this thing. I can just see all those dock workers staring at this good-looking blonde woman in a black Mercedes. Maybe you should borrow my car."
My bodybuilding deputy chief had just finalized a divorce and celebrated by trading in his Mustang for a red Corvette.
"Actually, that's a good idea," I dryly said, "if you don't mind, as long as it's a V8.
Yeah, I hear you. Call me if you need me. You know the way, right?"
"I do."
His directions led me south, and I was almost to Petersburg when I turned off and drove past the back of the Philip Morris manufacturing plant and over railroad tracks. The narrow road led me through a vacant land of weeds and woods that ended abruptly at a security checkpoint. I felt as if I were crossing the border into an unfriendly country. Beyond was a train yard and hundreds of boxcar-size orange containers stacked 3 and 4 high. A guard who took his job very seriously stepped outside his booth. I rolled down my window.
"May I help you, ma'am?" he asked in a flat military tone.
"I'm Dr. K. Scarpetta," I replied.
"And who are you here to see?"
"I'm here because there's been a death," I explained. "I'm the medical examiner." I showed him my credentials. He took them from me and studied them carefully. I had a feeling he didn't know what a medical examiner was and wasn't about to ask.
"So you're the chief," he said, handing the worn black wallet back to me. "The chief of what?"
"I'm the chief medical examiner of Virginia," I replied. "The police are waiting for me." He stepped back inside his booth and got on the phone as my impatience grew. It seemed every time I needed to enter a secured area, I went through this. I used to assume my being a woman was the reason, and in earlier days this was probably true, at least some of the time. Now I believed the threats of terrorism, crime, and lawsuits were the explanation. The guard wrote down a description of my car and the plate number. He handed me a clipboard so I could sign in and gave me a visitor's pass, which I didn't clip on.
"See that pine tree down there?" he said, pointing.
"I see quite a few pine trees."
"The little bent one. Take a left at it and just head on towards the water, ma'am," he said. "Have a nice day."
I moved on, passing huge tires parked here and there, and several red brick buildings with signs out front to identify the U.S. Customs Service and Federal Marine Terminal. The port itself was rows of huge warehouses, with orange containers lined up at loading docks like animals feeding from troughs. Moored off the wharf in the James River were two container ships, the Euroclip and the Sirius, each almost twice as long as a football field. Cranes hundreds of feet high were poised above open hatches, the size of swimming pools. Yellow crime scene tape anchored by traffic cones circled a container that was mounted on a chassis. No one was nearby. In fact, I saw no sign of police, except for an unmarked blue Caprice at the edge of the dock apron, the driver apparently behind the wheel, talking through the window to a man in a white shirt and a tie. Work had stopped. Stevedores in hard hats and reflective vests looked bored as they drank sodas, or bottled water, or smoked. I dialed my office and got Fielding on the phone. "When were we notified about this body?" I asked him. "Hold on. Let me check the sheet." Paper rustled. "At exactly 10:53." "And when was it found?" Anderson didn't seem to know that. "How the hell could she not know something like that?" "Like I said, I think she's new." "Fielding, there's not a cop in sight except for her, or at least I guess that's her. What exactly did she say to you when she called in the case?"
"DOA decomposed, asked for you to come to the scene."
"She specifically requested me?" I asked.
"Well, hell, you're always everybody's first choice. That's nothing new. But she said Marino told her to get you to the scene."
"Marino?" I asked, surprised. "He told her to tell me to respond?"
"Yeah, I thought it was a little ballsy of him."
I remembered Marino's telling me he would drop by the scene, and I got angrier. He gets some rookie to basically give me an order, and then if Marino can fit it in, he might swing by and see how we're doing. "Fielding, when's the last time you talked to him?" I asked.
"Weeks. Pissy mood, too."
"Not half as pissy as mine's going to be if and when he finally decides to show up," I promised. Dock workers watched me climb out of my car and pop open the trunk. I retrieved my scene case, jumpsuit, and shoes, and felt eyes crawl all over me as I walked toward the unmarked car and got more annoyed with each labored step, the heavy case bumping against my leg. The man in the shirt and tie looked hot and unhappy as he shielded his eyes to gaze up at two television news helicopters slowly circling the port at about 400 feet. "Darn reporters," he muttered, turning his eyes to me.
"I'm looking for whoever's in charge of this crime scene," I said.
"That would be me," came a female voice from inside the Caprice. I bent over and peered through the window at the young woman sitting behind the wheel. She was darkly tanned, her brown hair cut short and slicked back, her nose and jaw strong. Her eyes were hard, and she was dressed in relaxed leg faded jeans, lace-up black leather boots, and white T-shirt. She wore her gun on her hip, her badge on a ball chain tucked into her collar. Air conditioning was blasting, light rock on the radio surfing over the cop talk on the scanner.
"Detective Anderson, I presume," I said.
"Renee Anderson, the one and only. And you must be the doc I've heard so much about," she said, with the arrogance I associated with most people who didn't know what the hell they were doing.
"I'm Joe Shaw, the port director," the man introduced himself to me. "You must be who the security guys just called me about."
He was about my age, with blonde hair, bright blue eyes, and skin lined from years of too much sun. I could tell by the look on his face that he detested Anderson and everything about this day. "Might you have anything helpful to pass along to me before I get started?" I said to Anderson, over loud blowing air and flapping helicopter blades. "For example, why are there no police securing the scene?"
"Don't need 'em," Anderson said, pushing open her door with her knee. "It's not like just anybody can drive right on back here, as you found out when you tried."
I set the aluminum case on the ground. Anderson came around to my side of the car. I was surprised by how small she was.
"Not much I can tell you," she said to me. "What you see is what we got. A container with a real stinker inside."
"No, there's a lot more you can tell me, Detective Anderson," I said.
How was the body discovered, and at what time? Have you seen it? Has anybody gotten near it? Has the scene been contaminated in any way? And the answer to the last one had better be no, or I'm holding you responsible. She laughed. I began pulling the jumpsuit over my clothes. Nobody's even gotten close, she told me. No volunteers for that one. You don't have to go inside the thing to know what's there, Shaw added. I changed into the black Reeboks and put on the baseball cap. Anderson was staring at my Mercedes. Maybe I should go work for the state, she said. I looked her up and down. I suggest you cover up if you're going in there, I said to her. I gotta make a couple calls, she said, walking off. I don't mean to tell people how to do their jobs, Shaw said to me. But what the hell's going on here? We got a dead body right over there, and the cops send in a little shit like that? His jaw muscles were clenching, his face bright red and dripping sweat. You know, you don't make a dime in this business unless things are moving, he went on. And not a darn thing's moved for more than 2.5 hours. He was working so hard not to swear around me. Not that I'm not sorry about someone being dead, he went on. But I sure would like you folks to do your business and leave. He scowled up at the sky again. And that includes the media. Mr. Shaw, what was being shipped inside the container? I asked him. German camera equipment. You should know the seal on the container's latch wasn't broken, so it appears the cargo wasn't tampered with. Did the foreign shipper affix the seal? That's right. Meaning the body, alive or dead, most likely was inside the container before it was sealed? I said. That's what it looks like. The number matches the one on the entry filed by the customs broker. Nothing the least out of the ordinary. In fact, this cargo's already been released by customs. Was 5 days ago, Shaw told me. Which is why it was loaded straight on a chassis. Then we got a whiff and no way that container was going anywhere. I looked around, taking in the entire scene at once. A light breeze clinked heavy chains against cranes that had been offloading steel beams from the Euroclip, 3 hatches at a time, when all activity stopped. Forklifts and flatbed trucks had been abandoned. Dock workers and crew had nothing to do and kept their eyes on us from the tarmac. Some looked on from the bows of their ships and through the windows of deckhouses. Heat rose from oil-stained asphalt scattered with wooden frames, spacers, and skids, and a CSX train clanked and scraped through a crossing beyond the warehouses. The smell of creosote was strong, but could not mask the stench of rotting human flesh that drifted like smoke on the air. "Where did the ship set sail from?" I asked Shaw, as I noticed a marked car parking next to my Mercedes. "Antwerp, Belgium, 2 weeks ago," he replied as he looked at the Sirius and the Euroclip. "Foreign flag vessels, like all the rest we get. The only American flags we see anymore are if someone raises one as a courtesy," he added with a trace of disappointment. A man on the Euroclip was standing by the starboard yardarm, looking back at us with binoculars. I thought it strange he was dressed in long sleeves and long pants, as warm as it was. Shaw squinted. Darn, this sun is bright. What about stowaways? I asked. Although I can't imagine anyone choosing to hide inside a locked container for 2 weeks on high seas. Never had one that I know of. Besides, we're not the first port of call. Chester, Pennsylvania is. Most of our ships go from Antwerp to Chester to here, and then straight back to Antwerp. A stowaway's most likely going to bail out in Chester instead of waiting till he gets to Richmond. We're a niche port, Dr. Scarpetta, Shaw went on. I watched in disbelief as Pete Marino climbed out of the cruiser that had just parked next to my car. Last year, maybe 120 ocean-going ships and barges called in the port, Shaw was saying. Marino had been a detective as long as I'd known him. I had never seen him in uniform. If it were me and I was trying to jump ship or was an illegal alien, I think I'd want to end up in some really big port like Miami or L.A. where I could get lost in the shuffle. Anderson walked up to us, chewing gum. Point is, we don't break the seal and open them up unless we suspect something illegal. Drugs, undeclared cargo, Shaw continued. Every now and then we pre-select a ship for a full shakedown search to keep people honest. Glad I don't have to dress like that anymore, Anderson remarked, as Marino headed toward us, his demeanor cocky and pugilistic,
the way he always acted when he was insecure and in an especially foul mood. "Why's he in uniform?" I asked her.
"He got reassigned."
"Clearly.
There's been a lot of changes in the department since Deputy Chief Bray got here," Anderson said, as if she were proud of the fact.
I couldn't imagine why anyone would throw someone so valuable back into uniform. I wondered how long ago this had happened. I was hurt Marino hadn't let me know, and I was ashamed I hadn't found out anyway. It had been weeks, maybe a month, since I had called just to check on him. I couldn't remember the last time I'd invited him to drop by my office for coffee or to come to my house for dinner.
"What's going on?" he gruffly said as a greeting.
He didn't give Anderson a glance.
"I'm Joe Shaw. How you doing?"
"Like shit," Marino sourly replied.
"Anderson, you decide to work this one all by yourself. Or is it just the other cops don't want nothing to do with you?"
She glared at him. She took the gum out of her mouth and tossed it as if he had ruined the flavor.